Good morning, Indianapolis, Indiana, and other places that are near to and more remote. Out across the great American landscape, the Rockies, the East Coast, Florida, Alabama. There are people who live in Alabama. There are people in Texas and California. I mean, there are still people in California. I mean, I think they're probably going to flee that place eventually, but they're still there. Good morning. Good morning to all of you. Good morning, California. Good morning, Indianapolis. There are two things I can't believe in a way. I can't believe I'm about to podcast about the topic I'm going to podcast about, and I can't believe I made the choice of having a beer for breakfast on a Saturday morning. Now, for those of you who are going to judge, and I believe you should judge, you should know that it is a Lagunitas IPA, and it is really my favorite beer. It goes well, it pairs well with my other favorite thing. And so, yeah, it is Saturday morning, and I'm probably having an inappropriate cocktail for breakfast, but really, I'm divorced, and I'm male, and I'm almost 46 years old, and I'm overweight. You know, I think that the odds aren't great when you think about that future, you know, anyway. So I really don't worry too much about that. But the topic is also a bit on the, I don't know what's a good word for it. It might seem a bit remote and a bit, you know, out there. But anyways, many years ago, I worked on a project at the University of Washington Medical Center at Harborview that involved building or really, you know, building reports out of a clinical data repository that they had called Microsoft Amalga. And I've actually spoken about this before, written about this. It wasn't a very good experience. I mean, essentially, I was hired as essentially a BI analyst, you know, to basically write SQL queries against this system, and it was so badly designed. Like, for example, there are specific types of reporting, like infectious disease reporting, for example, that needs to happen, and it needs to happen quickly, and it needs to be accurate. So you got Cloverleaf, which is an integration engine that a lot of hospitals have, pulling in, you know, messages, HL7 messages, other kinds of messages. And then you have this repository extracting that information from Cloverleaf. And, you know, the repository should do is it should have essentially a kind of temporal queuing structure. So you have, you know, hot tables for stuff that's, you know, maybe 24 hours or 48 hours or 72 hours old or younger. And then you have, you know, older queues so that people who want to do proper analysis on data that isn't fresh can do the analysis, and that's no big deal. And people who want to do the infectious disease report, they don't have to hit hundreds of millions of records. Now, this is called common sense engineering. I think I was taught computer science properly. I technically don't have a bachelor's degree in computer science. I have a minor. You know, I have a bachelor's in science from Indiana University and a minor in computer science from Purdue. And you can ask yourself, how is that possible? Well, I went to IUPUI in Indianapolis a long time ago. It seems like a century ago. It was barely over a decade ago, but it seems like 1,000 years ago. But I had some good professors at IUPUI, and they taught me the right stuff, at least when it came to algorithms and data structures and topics of complexity and design. And so I've been more or less sympathetic to these more common sense engineering approaches to software rather than these kind of pie-in-the-sky fucking design pattern fucking Neoplatonist bullshit engineers who I don't know what they're fucking trying to build, but it certainly isn't good software. Anywho, while on that stupid project, I had a lot of time to think about how I would build an efficient data warehouse. And one of the things that occurred to me is that in the context of information, and this generally seems to be true, and it's something you can actually do yourself, writing your own little program. You can parse text and you can more or less prove this out yourself. But that the tokens, the individual tokens, and let me define a token is a sub string of natural language, like a sentence, like a word, even if the word has a period at the end, that is only separated by white space. So essentially, if I split a paragraph of text on its white space, everything that was left over after all white space was removed would essentially be a token. And so those tokens of natural language, which you could say make up the proper informal lexicon, because strictly speaking, the lexicon I'm describing involves things like, semicolons and apostrophes and periods and additional characters that have meaning that go beyond what one would consider to be like the dictionary meaning of a word. But essentially, the messy interpretation, the scruffy or interpretation of the data, means that these tokens are unique in the sense of how they're removed from the paragraph of text. Now, the basic idea is if I were to feed these tokens into like a hash table and I were to count them over time, what I would find is that the increase in the total unique set would be increasing at a decreasing rate, which means that even though I might have really high counts and frequencies for tokens within that space, because that would be expected for a language to be useful, you would expect repetition. That would be a feature of the language. You would expect to see things over and over again. But you would also expect the number of new things, the number of new unique things, to be increasing at a decreasing rate because people get more sophisticated, especially if the language is a sophisticated language. People get sophisticated with using tokens that already exist. And the truth is, most people, most humans' ordinary lexicon, their ordinary set of words, is not that big. A lot of people who design natural language processing often deal with a case scenario that is kind of unrealistic because most people do not have the whole dictionary in their head. They have some operational subset of words that they use over and over again. So how does this relate to data? Well, my perspective is this, that you can reduce all data. I don't care if it's PDF files or, Word documents or CSV files of raw data or HL7 messages. You can reduce the entire universe of data to really sub-universes or subsets of these tokens. And these tokens can be translated simply to a universe of integers. So then what you're really saying, and this is what's important, is that any data, no matter what the data is really just some kind of structured set of these little Markov streams of integers, essentially. And that what we do when we put the data into the warehouse is we reduce all the data to a set of integers. And so what you're ultimately dealing with in terms of relational analysis, in terms of even data mining, is simply the universe of integers once it passes through this kind of sieve. You can call it the value bus sieve or whatever. But what we're saying is, or at least what I'm saying is that, the universe of unique tokens is really a slowly changing dimension. And so why not build a kind of sieve or bus on the front end of all data warehouses that takes this token universe and basically translates all data into those tokens on the way in. So by the time it gets into the, warehouse, it's essentially all it is a universe of integers. Now there are some people who say, well, Dan, that sounds really crazy because why would we do that? Well, there might be a number of reasons. One, it allows you to answer certain questions very quickly, like does it exist? Because you can ask the does it exist question against the sieve itself, against that bus architecture, because it's designed by its very nature to answer that question. So there are a lot of queries that simply would fail quicker, faster, which is good. Failing fast on very large data warehouses for a query is a good thing because it means you don't have to wait around to find out if you're going to be trying to search for the wrong answer. And the other thing is this. What I'm describing is only one part of the problem. The other part of the problem is being smart about how you store the data. And in the case of like a clinical data warehouse, it does kind of make a lot of sense to think in terms of these temporal cues, because so much of the type of querying doctors want to do is based on time frames. And so time frames, along with, frankly, facility information or other stuff like that, could make a nice kind of queuing model. And again, you know, you could use SQL Server tables for these queues. You don't have to like create a whole new framework. You can certainly work within Oracle or SQL Server or MySQL, another, you know, and a number of other potential solutions like Postgres. You know, what I'm talking about are abstract data structures, not how you'd implement them. Anyways, as I thought about this and I thought about the different types of NoSQL approaches, and I've written about this on my blog, and I don't really want to belabor that point, I started thinking about what would be the perfect computer. And in a sense, the perfect computer would at least do one thing. And when I say perfect computer, let me be more specific. I really mean both operating system and physical architecture, because I'm going to talk about both separately. But for me, the perfect computer, which includes architecture and operating system, would have literally almost something on its front end, a physical architecture, a piece of architecture. And you can call this the value space bus. But what this thing would do is it would have hard-coded, let's call it the 99% or 90% solution, which is the currently understood universe of unique tokens. And this universe gets updated almost like a standard. Like, I can imagine this becoming almost like Unicode. And some people are going to say this is crazy, but before you call it crazy, it could be a powerful way to deal with a lot of computer problems. But in essence, I can imagine this service. And what this service does, all this service does, is provides you with the integer key for the universe of tokens. And if new tokens come into existence, these computers, with their little value bus architecture, communicates that back to the central service. Now again, this stuff could be turned on and turned off for security purposes. But what you need to understand is we're not talking about giving away data. We're talking about unique tokens. A unique token might mean something to someone, just like the name Dan might mean something to someone. But Dan by itself might not mean anything at all. So there are conversations we can have about security, but truthfully, if you don't know what the token's connected to, it is kind of useless. That's my opinion. There are some people who would say, well, what about new words or like neologisms? And I don't know. I mean, I just think that that's a separate issue. But the bottom line is this. Because you could turn this on or off, you could turn it off, and you could simply use the token set that's built in, and we could certainly have security features that let you see the token set in plain text. But the bottom line is this value bus would essentially, it would act like a kind of sieve, and it would translate all of the data coming into the system into streams of integers, each integer representing one of these tokens. And so basically, by the time a file gets into the OS, it really is just a file, which is a set of integers. Now, they might be integers that are formatted in different ways, and that certainly would be an aspect of the encoding scheme, but it would be just a set of integers. And certainly compression is another issue. Like, you know, would it make sense to compress these integer streams? And I think, yeah, it probably would, you know, because you certainly could gain leverage there. The other thing about this computer is it would have a topological OS. So essentially, graph theory and sort of the mechanics of topologies or graphs or networks would drive how the OS behaves. And so if you want to understand the operating system, you can imagine it as a interconnected graph of all these files in which the graph itself is fully indexed. So all the nodes are indexed, and there are complex indexing schemes that are also graph-like, you know, tree-like, graph-like. And all these connections basically create connections between these files that are dependency connections, and they can behave statistically at runtime, and they can have counts that are incremented and decremented. And you might ask, well, why, Dan? Well, because this would allow garbage collection. This would allow the decision of whether or not the OS, you know, puts something basically pages it out to a drive space or serialized space, or keeps it in RAM. Though, as we'll discuss later, that might be less relevant depending upon the physical architecture of the machine. So anyways, if you can imagine almost like a spider web, where the actual fibers of the web, the fibers of the web themselves, where they crisscross or interconnect as being nodes, and those nodes representing files on the computer, then when a file, which again, in my computer, like with Unix, everything's a file, including the programs, when a file gets loaded as a program, it's almost like the OS is a hand reaching down, plucking on that node, and pulling it up. So if you can imagine that, if you can imagine what I just described, it's almost like the kernel of the operating system is like this invisible hand, and it picks one of those nodes, which is also a file, and pulls it into process space, executable space, and it may be pulling multiple, you know, nodes up at a time. And as it does, depending upon the strength of the connections that file has to other kinds of information, based upon this topological index, other things might also get pulled into memory, into RAM. So basically, the topological scheme is really an indexing scheme. It's a countable scheme, which means you keep track of counting connections, references. Like, for example, if some file is referenced a lot, then it might make sense to leave that file in memory versus if a file is almost never accessed. Anyways, there's more to this than what I'm describing right now, but the key thing is this. The indexing model would be a topological index. It would be the kind of topological index that would allow for SQL-like searches, but frankly, for searches that SQL isn't very good at either. So it would be beyond SQL. And basically, the files themselves would be stored in such a way that you could, in fact, you know, query them very much the way you would query a database and get back data. So in essence, by design, this particular OS, and let's call it the topological OS, would also be a really great database. And I would also add that as far as the ports go, by design, every port could be opened up with a security password protocol to be a kind of feed forward, you know, type file queue or file endpoint and a read endpoint. So you could set up read ports and write ports. And these read ports and write ports would literally be exactly as I'm describing. Read write ports ultimately. Anyways, there's more to the mechanics of that too. But the key thing is to create a kind of operating system and a kind of computer that is already network aware and capable of acting as a service endpoint by design. The other thing too is that by design, this OS is designed to seek out other OSs like it. So by design, it wants to wire itself up to other nodes. That may seem scary to some people, but that is a good feature in a system where you want it to become a fully connected, like, grid computing environment or even a cloud environment. If you can imagine a kind of absolutely fluid cloud, that's essentially what we're talking about. And because they're using a common value space bus architecture and they can share common token schemes, they can exchange, what they're exchanging between each other is, once again, really just a universe of pure integers in whatever compression scheme or encryption scheme is required. Now, we've talked about the OS and the value space bus, but we haven't talked about the computer itself. And this is where things get really sci-fi. And I have to mention, this entire concept was based upon this work I was doing around data warehousing. But It's also related to a sci-fi story I have yet to write. I have notes on, but I have yet to write. And essentially, in the story, a character in the story, sort of, is this new kind of computer called Tyrix 12. And Tyrix 12 has a physical architecture that is essentially a kind of fluid von Neumann machine, or I should rather say, a self-organizing von Neumann machine, if such a thing makes sense. Basically, it utilizes a kind of fluid semiconductor structure, like a liquid crystal type structure, for reorganizing computer circuits and memory space so that the system itself can literally reorganize how it allocates drive space, memory space, and CPU, how the CPU is organized, and can even redesign itself around algorithms. So if you can imagine this, it's almost like taking an algorithm that could be reduced to AND/OR gates, logic gates on a computer, but even hard-coded. If you can imagine this, it's almost like the computer is capable of reshaping itself around the algorithm. So ultimately, from the programmer's perspective, from the operating system perspective, because to me, this operating system would also only work as if it supported, POSIX, POSIX and System 5 standards, and had a reasonably standard Unix-type interface. Because to me, the OS should also be inherently Unix-friendly by design. But yeah. So basically, this computer would have a completely fluid architecture. Like, quite literally, there is no printed circuit board. Well, there is a printed circuit board, but there is no, printed circuit on some chip. There is no printed chip. There is no printed RAM. The RAM is not a chip. There is no chip for that at all. There is no separate solid state hard drive. It's essentially this very large rectangular matrix of liquid semiconduction capable of reorganizing itself around algorithms, and then also capable of maintaining those structural shapes. Now, a lot of you will say, well, that sounds like really good science fiction, but not at all feasible. And I kind of have to agree with that. I don't think that this is really feasible, but it would be kind of amazing. It would require potentially nanotechnology. It might, in fact, really require, if not nanotechnology, the design of what I can only call holons, or these little tiny silicon structures that would allow for a kind of polybinding that treats them almost like a union space between rationalized logic units and memory units. Now, that doesn't make a lot of sense, but I'll explain it. Basically, these little holons would be capable of being both memory and logic, so they would basically operate with a fluid binding feature. So under current, under certain circumstances, they would bind in certain ways. Now, of course, I have no idea how you would engineer such things. So this is 100% science fiction. But it would be kind of amazing, because if you could imagine a computer capable of reorganizing itself around whatever the current algorithms are within the space of the OS, you can imagine a chip that could literally become the optimal chip for, neural network work, or work with, Bayesian models, or work with image processing, or you name it. You pick the application for the computer, and the computer would be capable of wrapping itself physically around the problem to become that efficient. So in theory, a computer like this could actually be very efficient, because it would be quite literally capable of turning off cylinders, so to speak, almost like, the truck with the V8 that can become a V6. I think it's kind of similar to that. So yeah, this is a weird topic, and I don't know. I'm not terribly upset. I'm not terribly upset that I ended up talking about it. But it is a kind of a meaty topic as far as the computer science stuff goes, or at least it can feel that way. The key thing about this, though, is the thought experiment of asking yourself, especially if you're in the data warehousing, business intelligence, data mining space, would there be value in being able to convert all data to some standard set or subset of data that really was only a universe of integers? Because when you think about it, if someone claims to have the ultimate AI algorithm, then it should be ultimate and devoid of heuristics, which means no references to hard-coded values anywhere. But that also implies that that algorithm would work on an anonymous data, which means if I literally gave that algorithm a giant array of integers and I said process, it should be able to derive meaningful connections, meaningful relationships, even though it has no idea what each individual integer actually represents, because the algorithm is working on the basis of some type of clustering algorithm, or some type of relational algorithm, or neural network algorithm, or tree-based algorithm. So in some ways, there's a certain kind of purity to this. Anywho, I belabored the point, and you know, Ubuntu is doing its software updater thing, and the sun is rising in the east, soon to set in the west. Have a great morning.